Well, I'm more excited to get into the series, the Gospel of Matthew. We're in the home stretch. I mean, we are in, this gospel took a turn last week, and I'll explain. It's the Gospel of Matthew. It's the series called To Fulfill What Was Spoken About Jesus. If he's the Messiah, he'll do this, be this, go here. So he fulfills all these things. Why do I say that? He ended the teaching part of his ministry last week, and now he's in the final week. It really is the final days of the final week. In fact, this chapter 26 starts with him having them throwing a farewell dinner for him. It ends with him being arrested, and he stays in custody until resurrection. So that's where we're at in the journey. Wow. But I want to just double back very quickly to last chapter before we go into chapter 26. And last chapter, as he ended all his teachings, he ended with what's called the Olivet Discourse. Olivet Discourse is a two-chapter teaching, some prophecy, some parables, about what it will be like at the end of days. It's all eschatological, meaning having to do with the last part of the end of times. Every part of it, even the parables. Now, he ended with one that is kind of considered a parable. It's called the Parable of the Sheep and Goats. But he just compares what will be at the end of the age to sheep and goats. So it's not really the kind of parable that says the kingdom of heaven is like and tells a fictional story. Just two verses from that we looked at. Last week, Matthew 25:32, it says, all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he's the nations being those that are the goyim or the ethna, that are not the people of God, but he gathers them, and he judges them how they treat the people of God. And here's how he says that. 25:40 says, the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of these, least of these my brethren, my people, you've done to me. And it just shows how important it is for the world to regard God's people with dignity, with respect, and in this case, with mercy, at the end of the age, when he rules and reigns. All right, so now we're going to get into Matthew 26. And Matthew 26, as I said before, he's done with the teaching part, and now it's the home stretch towards the cross and resurrection. And let's just get into it, and I'll tell you what's going to go on with this chapter. Starting with Matthew 26, verse 1. Matthew 26, starting with verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, as you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. Wow, right away. He says the Passover is 2 days away, and incidentally, I'm going to be crucified. Now, he had already been warning them in his journey that I'm going to Jerusalem, and I'm going to die, and I'm going to be crucified, and I'm going to rise again. But here it is. It's imminent. And also, this Passover thing, that's a big deal. The Passover, he says, as you know, how would they know? Because hundreds of thousands of people are coming from all over to gather in Jerusalem, because Passover is one of the three big holidays that hundreds of thousands of people come to Jerusalem for. Passover in the spring, Shavuot, which we call Pentecost in the early summer or late spring, and then finally Sukkot in the fall, that's Feast of Tabernacles. Thousands of people come. And this is what's happening. And these people that come for this Passover are going to witness something different than that's ever been witnessed before in the history of mankind. The Son of God being crucified and rising again. So all this is happening. But in the meanwhile, in the background, here's what's going on. Verse 3. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name is Caiaphas, and they schemed to arrest Jesus and secretly kill him. But not during the festival, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. Because Jesus is very popular right now. He's very popular, and they really feared the backlash of the people if they did something to him. So once again, hundreds of thousands of people are gathering. Jesus knows that his crucifixion is imminent. It's days away. And he visits Bethany. Not the person Bethany, but the town of Bethany. Bethany is a little village right outside Jerusalem. In fact, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, if you've ever been to Israel, you very likely went to the Mount of Olives. Or if you have a friend who's visited Jerusalem, they probably showed you a picture of their group on the Mount of Olives. And it's the picture where everybody's smiling and the Golden Dome is often, you know, down the hill a little bit. That's the most picturesque part of Jerusalem when you look at the old city. If you had gone back where those people are standing, just less than a mile, there's the remains of an old village called Bethany. And this is, I think, one of Jesus' favorite places to visit, home away from home, because he'd stay there, go to Jerusalem and teach and preach, come back and stay there. And he often would stay at the house of his best friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, little family, two sisters and a brother. So Bethany means house of dates. It's a small village. And Jesus is very familiar with Bethany because not just Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, but also a man named Simon the leper. Now, he's the one who's actually hosting the party. So it's a dinner party we're about to read about. And it takes place not at the home of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, but at their neighbor, Simon the leper. The apostles are all there. Lazarus was in attendance. And here's how it transpires. You ready? Matthew 26, verse 6. While Jesus was in Bethany, in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. "Why this waste?" they asked. "This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor." Aware of this, Jesus said to them, "Why are you bothering this woman? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will have always with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." Wow, what an experience we just saw here. I mean, this still moves me every time I read it. Because Jesus is at the table, and in Matthew's gospel, all it says is a woman poured this expensive perfume upon him. And it also says that the disciples were indignant, and some of the versions will say the disciples rebuked her, rebuked her. So we'll have to unpack this a little bit for this part of the gospel, because who is the person that's pouring this perfume, and who was it that rebuked? Well, I'll answer the first one. The person pouring this expensive perfume upon Jesus was Mary of Bethany, of those three siblings that I mentioned, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Now, the person that rebuked him, I'll tell you in a second, rebuked her. First of all, what is rebuke anyway? I don't, you know, it's like you buke someone, then you rebuke them until they can't buke them anymore. No, a rebuke is actually just harsh criticism. And the person that did this is Judas Iscariot. How do I know this? Because John's gospel actually explains it with a little more detail. John says of this incident in John 12, 4, but one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Now, you look at this scene. Okay, let's look at the cast of characters as if this was a drama unfolding. So obviously you have Jesus. He's first and foremost. And he's on his way to Jerusalem. He's passing through Bethany. In fact, at this point, he's going back and forth from the city to the neighborhood, city to the neighborhood. He's about to die, just as he predicted. And then you have Simon the leper. And Simon the leper is someone who Jesus presumably healed. Simon the leper was probably not still a leper because, you know, if he was a leper, the finger food he would have been serving. Well, never mind. Don't worry about it. Because he would not have been able to host a party. He'd be quarantined and he would be, you know, off limits. Then Lazarus, at this point, is a very famous person. Lazarus, the one he had raised from the dead, is famous because Jesus raised him from the dead. In fact, because of that, he was a marked man. Let me show you. John 12, 9 and 10 says, when the people heard of Jesus' arrival, they flocked to see him and also to see Lazarus, the man Jesus raised from the dead. And then the leading priests decided to kill Lazarus too, for it was because of him that many of the people had deserted them and believed in Jesus. So Lazarus is a marked man. They want to kill him also along with Jesus. Then you have Martha. Martha is seemingly the head of the house. Martha is, it's because sometimes in Luke, for instance, Luke 10, it talks about Martha's house. And she's probably the older of the three siblings. And then, of course, you have Mary. And I mentioned this is Mary of Bethany. Now, there's a lot of Marys in the New Testament. You have Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, but this is Mary of Bethany, this beautiful woman who does this incredible thing for Jesus. Of course, you have Judas. Judas is the one who betrayed Jesus later. But bear in mind, there was no suspicion about Judas yet. I will tell you when we look later in the chapter in a couple weeks, when they're at the Last Supper and Jesus says, one of you will betray me. And they're all thinking to themselves, here's what they weren't thinking. They weren't thinking, oh, yeah, we know which one's going to betray that guy down at the end. Judas Iscariot, he's the thief. They didn't know. They actually said, is it I, Lord? Is it me? Who? Who would betray you? So Judas was very sneaky guy. And then, obviously, the disciples were all there. Now, it's important to know this about Jesus, and this really strikes me every time. Jesus had friends. Of course, he had the apostles, and they were his friends. But Jesus had friends, and he was enjoying this dinner party in his honor. And, you know, his close friends were there. I mean, Jesus, obviously, he knew what was ahead of him. He knew that by the end of the week, he'd be on the cross and in the grave. And yet, here he is, just sharing this tender moment, cherishing this moment, looking around the table at these who have walked with him, some who are not his apostles, they were just his close friends, like Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, and Simon, friends. And, you know, he's being lavished upon by Mary with this expensive spikenard, this oil, this perfume, probably comes from India, that was worth a year's wages, just the jar of it, the ultimate in essential oils, just pouring over him. And I want to tell you his experiences with these guys, because sometimes we look at Jesus as just very stoic and, you know, probably not real emotionally invested in other people because he was so driven on God's will for his teaching, cross, resurrection, ascension. But he loved these people. In fact, John 11:5 says, now Jesus loved Mary and her sister and Lazarus. I mean, that's a standalone verse. He loved Mary. He loved Martha. He loved Lazarus. They're his friends. And, you know, as friends, you ever have a friend of a family, you know, somebody that's just more than a close friend? It's like they come over and, you know, they eat out of your refrigerator and things like that. I mean, I was growing up, we always had like somebody, a close friend, like a neighbor, you know, that we really liked, that grew up with, and we're just kind of part of the family. So you could have arguments with them and things like that, and they still stick around. That's how it was with Jesus and this family. John 10, he was visiting their home. Verse 40, it says, but Martha was distracted by the big dinner she was preparing. And she came to Jesus and said, Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits there while I do all the work? Tell her to come help me. And he says in verse 41, my dear Martha. Some versions say, Martha, Martha. Brady Bunch version says, Martha, Martha, Martha. But you are worried and upset over all these details. There's only one thing worth being concerned. Mary's discovered, and it will not be taken away from her. It's like this candor, this real casual almost. John 11, verse 20, when their brother died, and they're probably mad at Jesus. I mean, you could tell that they've talked among themselves. If Jesus would have been here, our brother wouldn't have died. You're right. If Jesus was here, our brother wouldn't have died. Now Jesus shows up. Their brother's dead. Verse 20, when Martha got word that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus told her, your brother will rise again. Yes, Martha said, he'll rise again when everyone else rises at the last day. And Jesus told her, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyone who believes in me will live, even after dying. Everyone who lives in me and believes in me will never, ever die. Don't you believe this, Martha? Yes, Lord, she told him. I've always believed you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one who's come into the world. But then Mary shows up and says the same thing. Mary arrived and saw Jesus. She fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had only been here, my brother would not have died. You could see the discontent. Now, the reason I'm saying this is you see the relationship that they had with him. I know for me, if I had a relationship with Jesus, every time he walked in, I'd be like, King of kings, Lord of lords, I worship you. You know, I wouldn't say, hey, if you had been here, you know, come on, what gives? That's how close they were, tight-knit they were. Yet, here they are in this last meal, this final dinner. I mean, they knew it. He knew it. He's here for the last time. It's the last visit before he dies. And that's what was heavy in this house. And that's why she recognized the moment. Up until this point, they could hold Jesus' hand. They could speak to him face to face. But that will change this week. And she wanted to capture that moment. And she took this alabaster jar filled with this expensive perfume. And she just lavished it upon him. Lavished it upon him. It's an act of ultimate worship. And she was made fun of. She was ridiculed. She was criticized. She was rebuked. Verse 26:10, Jesus defends her. Why are you bothering this woman? She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. You know, and sometimes I look at this and I'm somewhat puzzled because I think, you know what, Jesus could have stopped her and said, I get the intent. It's a thought that counts. But really, really, take that jar before you pour it. Sell it. Give the money to the poor. I mean, that would have seemed like a proper, prudent way to redirect resources to people in need, which seems like it would be the most important thing. But Jesus commended her and condemned that notion. Why? Why didn't he sell the money, sell the oil and give the money to the poor? Because Mary's actions were a true heart of love and worship to Jesus. To Jesus. Judas's suggestion, as disingenuous as it was this, is that, oh, there's something more important than that. And that's just kind of, you know, meeting the immediate needs, financial needs of those around us. And it's interesting because both are really important and appropriate at the right times. But what Mary was doing took precedent over the other. Now, it was similar to what we looked at back in Luke. Martha's preparing a meal. It's really important. How are you going to eat? You know, how are you going to host? But Mary just sat there. This is the other Mary. Mary just sat there, and she was commended for sitting at Jesus' feet. Friends, sometimes we can get distracted with this whole idea that the whole reason Jesus came was for wealth distribution, or to, you know, to distribute power from the powerful to the oppressed, and forget about God. Forget about him, but that is not what we're commanded to do. In fact, the greatest commandment is to love God with everything you got. And second to that is to love our neighbor as yourself, which is also really important. Well, Matthew 22:37, when he was asked about what's the greatest thing we could possibly do, what's the greatest commandment? You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest of the laws. And that's exactly what Mary was doing. The second is like it, and that's to love your neighbor as yourself. But if we mix up these priorities, we mix up the priorities of the kingdom of God. We can't do that. And it's confusing sometimes. It's tempting. I mean, I love to give to the needy. It makes me feel good. I love to give to those that are in need, even secretly. I mean, when we went to Haiti, Haiti's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. I've been there twice. And it's really gratifying to know that there's a starving person and you can actually give them, you know, a case of food. Or I remember giving a block of a package of batteries to this woman in a village, and this whole family just thought it was gold because that's all they had. How about this? When they get a wound, even a scratch or a cut, it just gets infected and because they don't have Band-Aids. They don't have any kind of ointments that could, you know, antibacterial ointments. I gave a box with a little antibacterial and Band-Aids to a family. I mean, they might have just as well started worshiping me because what I get, and it's a great feeling. It's a great feeling. And I believe it pleases God. But I can do that and forget about God. In fact, I have close friends that do what I just described way more than I do. And they don't even believe in God. They don't even believe in God. And they are mixing it up. In fact, it's more important to worship God, to direct our attention to him, to love him, show us how much we love him, and he gives us the love to love others with. Paul talks about this in the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. He says, in verse 3, if I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. I'll even qualify that. Love for God. I mean, who are we supposed to love more than anything is God. And my friends, I'll tell you, that they will outgive me and outperform me in terms of, you know, social gospel, social justice. But some of them don't even believe in God. 2 Timothy 3:5 says, having a form of godliness, but denying its power. Jesus knew what Mary was doing, and he allowed it. He allowed it because she was, her priorities were right for that moment. Now, Judas, on the other hand, he was the one that had concocted the idea. Let's sell that stuff. Hey, before you pour it, hold on. Jesus gets it. He knows you love him. Let's take this. Let's go to the marketplace. Let's sell it. And let's put that money into the money bag. I keep track of the money bag. Let's put it in the money bag. Judas was always on the take. He did not love Jesus. He didn't care about him. We see this right away in the next verse, verse 26, 14. Then one of the 12, and this is the first time he's identified here in this situation in Matthew, one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, okay, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him over to you? Wow. So they counted out for him 30 pieces of silver, and from then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Isn't that interesting? Now, that 30 pieces of silver is from a prophecy in the Old Testament, Zechariah 11, that this would happen. Jesus knew that it would happen. But listen, don't you see the contrast here? What just took place in what we just read? Mary gave a year's wages worth of this spikenard and just lavished it upon Jesus because she cared and valued him. Judas, a couple verses later, is willing to take 30 pieces of silver, chump change, to just hand him over to be crucified. Friends, we see the contrast because Mary loved Jesus. She gave all that she had to Jesus. She felt like, if I could, I'm just seeing him for the last time here in Bethany, if I could just extravagantly show him how much I love him, even at my own detriment, even if it really costs me, show him how much Jesus resonated with that heart. He received it. She gave all that she has. And you know what? That spikenard was really powerful stuff. That perfume is not the cheap stuff that wears off, you know, a couple hours later. It stayed fragrant upon him. It stayed fragrant upon him when he went from there to the Last Supper and said, this is my body, this is my blood. He stayed with this fragrance upon him when he was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. He still smelled like it when he was being whipped and beaten and the crown of thorns upon his head. He still smelled like this ointment because it's the lasting ointment. And when he was being nailed to the cross, the soldiers pounding the spikes would have smelled this expensive fragrance upon this man's body who they're crucifying. And you know what? They laid him in the tomb, and the inside of the tomb had the aroma and the fragrance of Mary's spikenard. And that's why he said, she's preparing my body for burial. She gave all that she had, complete devotion. She gave complete devotion, demonstrating that she was more interested in honoring Jesus than anything else in her life. Number two, she was giving Jesus her reputation. She knew the ridicule and the humiliation. She knew what the people on the streets were going to be saying. You did that for a guy you're not even married to? That guy? What kind of woman are you? She didn't care. She gave Jesus her reputation. And she was giving Jesus her future. Many believe that this jar was probably not one of many. It was probably the only really valuable possession that she had. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't have anything in my house that's worth a year's wages, you know. But she did. And she was saving it. It's very likely that it was something left from her father, who's not in the picture anymore. We don't know anything about him, but he's not there. Maybe her dowry. This is my value to be possibly married someday. Who knows? But it was the most likely the most expensive and extravagant and valuable thing that she owned. It represented her future. Whew. She gave it to Jesus. She could have played it safe. She could have just said, okay, Jesus, you know what I mean, but I'm saving this. I need it. You know, you're leaving us. I got this. No, no, no. She gave complete love, complete devotion. She gave her reputation. She gave her future. She blessed Jesus, and he blessed her for it. You know, he gave her a blessing that's really an everlasting blessing, a commendation, a compliment even. He says in Matthew 26:13, right after, he says, truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached, which, by the way, is the most important thing to be preached anywhere, the gospel, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. And it's being told right now, here, February 22nd, 2026, in memory of her, to remember her, to remember her complete devotion to Jesus. This legacy moves me. I hope it moves you too. This example of extravagant worship and love for Jesus moves me. When we give our heart fully to the Lord, he takes it. He transforms it. He uses everything we have and works mightily through us, in us, around us when we give it to him. So the question, do you want to have a lasting legacy that is remembered beyond your lifetime? I promise you, you can, by giving yourself wholly and devoted to the Lord. Giving him your resources, your possessions, anything you hold dear, just offer it to him. We're not going to take another collection. I don't care. It's not about that. It's about you saying, God, here's what my storehouse is. Here's what I'm saving. I give it to you. I give it to you. I worship you with that. Wow. And then he blesses us with eternal blessing in response. Eternal life is just the beginning of it. Abundant life is here as well. So this is what it means to love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind. And from that, he will in turn give us the ability not only to love our neighbors as ourselves, but to love one another as he has loved us. I want to leave you with this verse. It's not in my notes. It's not on the screen. But it's James 4:8, and it says this. This is a promise. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Draw near to God, and watch what happens. We'll draw near to you.